I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Jillian McKercher joins me now. She's written and directed a new film, Lucky Star. It's a terrific movie set in Calgary, where Lucky, played by Terry Chen, once a gambler, has since settled down with a wife, two daughters, a business, and a mortgage. He falls for a tax scam, and after losing a good chunk of money and saddled with more bills that pile up, he realizes he might have to go back to his gambling ways to recover his losses and keep afloat. His wife Noelle, played by Olivia Cheng, and daughter Grace, played by Connie Mew, also have moral dilemmas of their own. Naturally, they're opposed to his gambling. The film is a great look at familial bonds, deceit, and sacrifice. It's wonderfully paced and gripping to watch. It's a marvelous addition to the Asian-Canadian film genre. Jillian joins me now to talk about this film, Identity, and more. She is a writer, director, and producer based out of Calgary. Her first feature, Circle of Steel, was critically acclaimed and the winner of the Audience Award at the 2018 Calgary International Film Festival. Visit JillianMcKercher.com for more. The film screens 6:30 p.m. Thursday, the 3rd of October at the International Village Cinema. There's another screening Saturday, the 5th of October at 12:30 p.m. Jillian is scheduled to attend both screenings for Q&As. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jillian McKercher. Ms. McKercher, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the film. I booked this interview not knowing very much about the movie because, you know, I don't want to have anything in my mind as I'm starting it, you know. For example, I didn't know much about who Lucky was and what his problem was. I have to say, not knowing what's going to happen in the film, you do a marvelous job in building the suspense, the tension, if you will. Because it could go, you know, several ways in terms of what you think is going to happen. When you're writing a film like Lucky Star, did you have fun in terms of when you tell the audience what you want to tell them, say?
Yes. The writing process is both the best and the worst. I think any writer could tell you that when you first get an idea, you're full of inspiration, a lot of energy, and then as you go through the plot and discover who your characters are, and then maybe something you had an idea of doesn't pan out, and your plans have to change, it can be quite painful. But it is really fun thinking about, okay, well, what's the audience thinking of? And in this film specifically, I kept thinking, like, respect the audience, what's keeping them, what's engaging them. And I don't think that is selling out. I think it's the dance, right? Like,
yeah.
As a filmmaker, I want to engage with the audience, and I do want them to be entertained. And it also helps having readers who can give really good feedback on the script. So I started writing it in 2019,
mm-hmm.
And we went to camera in 2023 in January. So that entire period, I was working on the script in bits and pieces.
Yeah, because when we first see Lucky, we see him outside of the house, and then we see him when he enters the house. He's obviously married to this woman, but the first sort of real interaction is with the daughter Grace, and they're talking to each other very secretly, I guess. So he's going about rather furtively, and so we get an idea right away that he has relationships with people in this one household itself that are very different than say a lot of people would expect, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're coming up with the gambling is something that comes up in the film. Poker itself, it lends itself well, doesn't it, in terms of building suspense?
Absolutely. I like poker because, and actually when I was developing the piece, I actually didn't have Lucky start out as a poker player. I imagined him more as falling for, you know, a Ponzi scheme or multi-level marketing or something.
Sure.
But what I really like about poker, and specifically in-person poker, is that it makes you think that you're the smartest person because you're gaming everybody else.
Yeah.
And what I like about it, too, is you're not on a computer screen. Like, people who play in-person poker believe that they can read other players. You only are playing that one game at a time. So if you're playing online poker, you could be playing multiple games at once, and you could have other programs to assist you in the probability of certain hands. But when you're there in person, it's totally different. Like, I think you're a bit of an adrenaline junkie. And when I thought about poker, it just lent itself so perfectly to Lucky's character that he would say, I am in control of this situation. I can see what's going to happen, and I'm going to win. And every single hand he plays, he changes his, like, he's like, this is the one, this is the one, this is the one. And I really like that from a narrative perspective.
Yeah, and filming the cards themselves, that must be fun, too, because you can just buy the cards that you pick, say, what one's hand is or what the house hand is, if you call it that. That's built in suspense right there.
Yes. I actually consulted with a professional poker player to go over what he thought was realistic or what made sense for the cards themselves.
Yeah.
I know there is one game where he goes to an old friend's place to play, and I really wanted to show that you can win a game by folding. And so whether or not the audience understood to create one hand, at least cinematically, where he doesn't even reveal his cards, because I feel like that's always a cinematic thing, where we always see the cards be revealed, but... When I've played poker, that doesn't actually happen all the time. You often fold. Like, the game itself doesn't even progress to the, and now we both show our hands. I wanted to play with, in the film, there's like the king queen suited is a running motif.
Yeah.
And that was fun to play with, like, what that means, what it might not mean. But if you're a poker player, it definitely means something. Like, you assign meaning to these things.
And that says a lot, doesn't it, about Lucky, that his personality is that he thinks he's in control of a lot of things. But as we learn in life itself, we're not in control, and a lot of it is luck, too, isn't it?
I think it's a bit of both. I think life is hard work, and a little bit of timing, a little bit of luck, and you have to be ready for the luck when it hits.
Yeah.
And I think that we can often be delusional or be avoidant of the problems in our life by saying, oh, well, if I do this shortcut, like, it'll work out because it's worked out in the past. I think about luck all the time. I mean, the luck of who your parents are, or the luck of where you're born, the luck of your situation. I think about Lucky and Noelle, and I don't know if it's luck per se, but they had their daughter, their eldest daughter, when she was quite young. And I wonder what would have happened if, you know, they didn't get pregnant with her. Like, their life probably would have been different. Or, you know, if they weren't in Calgary, if they weren't in the Midwestern city, like, how would their life be different? Or if Lucky wasn't living in North America, but if instead he was born and raised in Asia, how would his life be different? So... those are things that I thought about a lot when I was writing.
Yeah, and one small change changes everything, doesn't it?
Oh, totally. Or one small choice that you make, like he doesn't pay his tickets, right? And then his car gets towed, which I don't even know if that's bad luck. It's just, you know, it's too bad. That sort of thing happens. That's happened to me. It was like a devastating thing. And then you're just like, well, I guess I had it coming because I didn't want to pay these tickets. But it feels like bad luck, and then it just makes you feel that the world is against you, and that, you know, someone is trying to tell you something. At least that's how I felt when I'm like, oh my God, my car got towed, and now it's so expensive, and now I'm going to have to ask someone for help to pay. It's like, it's just humiliating.
Yeah.
but that was in my control.
Yeah, and how Lucky deals with humiliation itself. I mean, that's a fascinating thing, and I kept wondering. Is it cultural, or is it just specific to Lucky? Is it this? Could it be from the fact that he was a gambler at one point, and as a result, it was quite it didn't turn out well, if you will. Why does Lucky do what he does?
Okay, this is a hot take, but this is my take.
Yeah.
I really admire Lucky's, he doesn't let bad things get to him too much. He's just kind of like, oh, a bad thing happened. Okay, I'm on to the next. I'm going to persevere and think about something else to focus on and work towards. Now, is this good always? No, because it means he's not reflective and he's not, you know, sitting with his problems and the situations that have happened to him in life. But there is this sort of regenerative quality about him, which I find a lot of people with addictive personalities, such as gambling, have, where they think, okay, next time it will be different. And I find that very attractive. And I wanted to celebrate that in sort of a strange way. I think that's what keeps his family loving him and connected to him. So I don't think it's necessarily cultural. I do think it's just a part of a gambling attitude. Like, if you're still going to the gambling table, it's because not only maybe are you suffering from an addiction, but often you're thinking, this time it'll be different. And I love that quality in people, where when you're down, you're like, well, my luck's going to turn around. So I like to think that Lucky is changing. Like, I do like to think that by the end of the film, when he comes back to his house right before the end of the film, that he's ready to think about why he is in his situation and think about the decisions he's made. But that's also up to the audience to think whether or not he's learned his lesson, so to speak.
Yeah. It's fascinating who he turns to for help when he needs to. It's often not the person that he should turn to, but it's fascinating nonetheless, because, I mean, I mentioned that first real conversation we see of him in the film. He goes to his daughter, his eldest daughter, and there's an exchange of money. And it's fascinating how much is left out of, you know, what he does in the sort. To this scam that he falls for. It's something that we hear a lot about in the news. I'm sure, you know, we've known people who have maybe not the large sum of money that Lucky loses, but certainly have fallen to scams on the phone or online. It's almost insidious to think about how prevalent that is in our culture, isn't it? To lose money like that.
Well, yeah, I almost fell for a scam like that. Like,
really?
Almost went the whole way. So I'm a small business owner. I do my own taxes. And I got a call. It was before I started writing the film, but I got a call from one of these scammers, and they told me that I had not paid certain taxes, and I got really scared because I believed that I could have done these things, like not done filed my taxes properly. Luckily, I didn't end up going to buy any gift cards. I hung up the phone.
Yeah.
But the more I started investigating this story, there are so many news stories. But what I read online is that actually hundreds of millions of dollars in North America are lost to this. And law enforcement actually thinks that there's more, that we're only hearing about maybe 20% of the scams which people are falling for, because the humiliation and shame that people feel when they fall for a scam keeps them silent.
Yeah.
And that also really got me excited from a narrative perspective, because I'm like, okay, this is an unspoken thing that everybody knows about. And also, the people who don't fall the scam love to judge those who do fall for the scam. Everyone who I talk about is like, well, I would never fall for something like that. There's this smugness, this condescension towards people who are like buying gift cards at Shoppers Drug Mart. But that got me excited when I thought about Lucky, where he knows he's done something wrong, so he's not paying his taxes. He gets a phone call that says, you're not paying your taxes, so he can believe that he has committed a moral error. It's easy for him to believe that. So, it is insidious that these people exist, but I also understand why they exist. It's because one thing I was interested in the film is, you know, if you're born into a situation where you don't have a lot of generational wealth, if you're not a professional and maybe you're only making just above the minimum wage, it's really hard to make your ends meet and to keep up appearances, especially in a country like Canada. So what other means do you pursue to get money? And in Leslie's case, he gambles. In other people's cases around the world, they have to scam people. So I'm interested in that.
Yeah. And in Lucky's situation, I was watching the film, and there were a couple of instances where I was thinking to myself, you know, if he had just told Noel what had happened, things would probably be fine. But at the same time, you know, I can see how he would be humiliated. He would be ashamed of what happened because he did fall for it. And yet he knows that he can work his way out of it. And I guess that's the addictive personality part, that it works up to a certain point and then it doesn't, right?
Exactly. I think if I just have a little bit more time.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it's almost as if it never happened.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He got scammed the money, which if he had told Noel he got scammed, then he also has to admit that he hasn't been paying their taxes. And also that they don't have the money. All of these things are highly emasculating, I think, in the relationship. And we can see in their fighting that she's always, you know, sadly nagging him, being like, have you paid this? Do you have your shit together?
Mm-hmm.
And it's because she knows. And I can only imagine for him, he's just like, trust me. It makes him want to, like, lash out and push her away. So I understand why he doesn't want to tell her right away, because there's already a breach of trust in the relationship, and it's very shaky. And when he goes to his daughter for help, Grace, that makes sense to me too, because there's a power dynamic there. She's the daughter, she loves him, they understand each other in a way which is different than him and his wife.
The scene where Lucky, played by Terry Chen, realizes that he's been had, it's all in the eyes. And you know, the people watching, you know, may think, well, they'd do it differently if they were the director, but it's so effective in the film. I'm curious to know, what kind of conversations do you have with an actor as to how to play a scene like that? Because as I said, it's all in the eyes. There's very little that he does physically. And there's very little that happens on the screen as he realizes this. I mean, we were hearing, you know, him process it, I guess, over the phone, talking to someone. But as a director, how do you talk to your actors when you're filming a scene so intense like that?
Well, I'm so happy that you asked me about this specific scene, because I had envisioned and blocked it out in pre-production, even while I was developing it. The location where we shot this, Lucky's repair shop, mm-hmm. is actually just down the street from my house. So I had been going there as a patron for many years before we actually shot in there. And when I got to the scene to shoot it with Terry, I was like, okay, this is what you're going to do. You're going to walk around. He's frantic. He's moving around the store. We're going to follow you with the camera. And Terry actually said, after we had blocked it, he's like, you know, Jillian, we can do it your way, but I think that if I got the phone call, I would be just stunned, and I think I would just be still and sit in my chair. And the last thing I would want to do would be to run around. So can we try that? So we tried it his way, and we did it in a single take, and I think it's far more effective. And that was a really nice collaborative moment between Terry and me, where he, like, listened, we tried it out, and then he said, you know, it's just not feeling – something's feeling off for me. Like, I think – if I'm going to realize that, yeah, I've been scammed, I'm going to have to just be like, oh my effing God, like, I can't believe this. And I'm going to feel sick to my stomach. Like, I'm not going to want to be like a bouncy rabbit around the store. So as a director, I have to come as prepared as I can and have a vision for what we're going to accomplish that day. But I think part of that preparation is also being open to the collaboration that comes from your performers. And by that point, Terry and I had worked together for a few days. We had started to feel each other out. He was really understanding Lucky, and I was ready to hear his proposal, and we as a team were ready to just react to his suggestion. And I directed the camera team, told them what we had to do, and then we went for it. And I'm so happy we did. I think in his life, in the film, he's always moving around, but that's one of the moments where he's still, and it is all in his eyes, and it's a real moment of humility for him.
Yeah, and then you think any minute now he could get up and trash the place, or start shouting or doing, you know, but you see everything. I mean, you do see him. Like you do want to throw up for him as you're hearing this, cry even, or, you know, but the way he does it with such restraint, it's just marvelous to see in the film. What can you tell us about this trip to Las Vegas all those years ago? Because that's another fascinating thing in terms of the narrative that I found delicious to watch, that you give us these little morsels. And, you know, even after having watched the film, I don't know exactly what happened, but you've given us enough that it does shape their lives and how they comport themselves, even in the film that we see. I guess when you're writing the film, you do have to to tempt the viewer from time to time, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Also, it's just fun to, like, I'm a filmmaker who loves writing. I love a conversation. I love dialogue-driven stories. And it's fun for me to write conversations like that. So the path to Las Vegas, I liked it because it showed that there was a time. There are a few reasons why I like a past trip to Las Vegas where he would have played poker. I liked it because it shows his thinking about past glory days. Mm. And it shows also his strength as a poker player. Like, he went to a professional tournament. He did very well. He beat a well-known, established poker player. Him and his buddy can reminisce it, kind of like the good old days. But I also liked it, too, because while Lucky has a narrative in his head about that memory, his wife has a totally different narrative in her head about that. So there's two competing stories while they both experience the same thing. And actually, his friend Toon, the buddy who they went down to play poker with, they all have different stories. And I think that is something I'm also interested by, is we all tell ourselves different stories, but we're all experiencing, I guess, technically, we're still experiencing the same events, but we all digest and interpret them separately. So I like the idea, too, that later on when Lucky is talking to Noelle, his wife, about that trip to Vegas, she immediately belittles him about it, and that shows their dynamic. He's going to her asking for some reinforcement, some confidence-building nostalgia, and she sadly just squashes him and is like, dude, that was a terrible trip.
The other thing I was wondering about was the car itself, because that's nearly a character in the film as we see it throughout the movie. How did you go about choosing the right kind of car for Lucky?
Well, straight up, I am a huge, like, I was a big Fast and Furious fan when I was younger, and my cousin is a huge car guy, and similar to what I imagined that Lucky would have been, so would have seen Fast and Furious, would have been around the time of, like, Romeo Must Die, and my cousin, at least, got really into, modified vehicles and racing, street racing. And so when I talked to my cousin about Lucky and what sort of vehicle he would have to indicate that he was a cool guy and he knew something about cars, my cousin was like, oh, here's a list, but I think you should have a Mitsubishi Eclipse because it's a V6, you can modify it, it was, like, super good back then, but it's underrated, still excellent, and this is important, it is the most inefficient and inconvenient vehicle for a family father to have in winter. Like, it's just outrageous that he's holding on to this car where he has two daughters who he has to, like, taxi around the city. Yeah. So those are a few things that I really loved about it, and I also just from a visual perspective, I love the idea of somebody in a red car. It just stands out. So that's a short history of the car. But I took it extremely seriously. Like, we found it, some guy was just driving on the street, and I was with my husband, and we followed him to a parking lot, and we put a little note on his windshield, and he actually called us back, and he was so flattered, and of course, was into Fast and Furious, et cetera, et cetera. So we got to rent our car from somebody who fit the character of Lucky.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to see this car move in the film, whether it's in the daytime or especially at night. In those empty streets, say, of where they live, we see it parked in front of the house as well. It isn't a family car, which is also fascinating, and it's just great to see. You know what I mean? And I'm not a car person itself, but seeing that car said a lot about who he was, right away even.
Yeah. And yeah, my cousin was so funny. He even told us this is the sort of keychain he would have for his keys. And that doesn't play out in the film, but yeah. It does indicate what sort of character he had. I wish that I had gone further with it. I wish that Noelle maybe said something like, "I can't believe you still have that stupid car," but you know, I'm very pleased to have it in the film.
There's another theme in the film. That plays out, and it's the youngest daughter, Jenny, and her relationship with her Chinese heritage. I mean, my parents are Filipino, and so, you know, that itself plays out in the film. I mean, that's not uncommon for kids of immigrant parents. Was it important for you to include that, Sam? I mean, she's not one of the, she's an important character in the film, but not one of the central characters, but that thread plays out from the beginning to the end, doesn't it?
Yeah. And when you mean the cultural aspect that she goes to
Chinese school,
she doesn't enjoy it very much. And when her dad engages with her about, say, Bruce Lee, she's like, yeah, I don't know. I don't really care. I was just playing to life in that one, so that character is actually played by my cousin. Summer Lai is my cousin, and I've just observed there's always a tension when you're being told as a child to engage with something. So I have friends who are Jewish, and they have this tension when they have to go to Hebrew school, for example, I went to Chinese school until I was 12. And it was a really positive experience in the larger picture of my life, but it was something I didn't want to do. I didn't want to go for 3 hours on a Saturday when my friends were out, what I thought, you know, hanging out with their friends or going to swimming lessons. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a painful process when you are assimilating into North America, where there's both a retention of culture, but there is an inevitable letting go of culture or loss of culture. And I think that the parents have already gone through that to some degree, and now we're seeing it happen with the youngest daughter, Jenny, because her parents are still telling her she has to do these things for the sake of culture, even though she's not otherwise inherently interested in it. So it's just a small thing that I'm interested in.
Yeah, it's a fascinating. It's something that a lot of us have gone through, and it's fascinating to see that play out in the film, because going to where she goes for these lessons, it's often quite colorful to see. You know, the dancing and the sword, and it's a really great way to contrast that or compare that to. Sort of the desolation and the cold and the gray when we see Lucky at his lowest moments.
That was something that was intentional too. Yeah. I really the lion dancing gym that you see in the film is actually it's housed in a warehouse by the airport,
uh-huh.
And it just looks, especially in the middle of winter, it just looks like horrible out there. You're like, oh my gosh, just super depressing. But then when you go inside, it's so warm and full of life, and I wanted to see that. I wanted to contrast the two, the world of like inside and life and something wholesome, and then also like the bleakness of winter and Lucky's gambling, like the places where he goes to gamble, like the final house at the end of the film where he goes to gamble, a suburban house. It just is so bland. Something I thought about.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful film to watch and a great story. Congratulations on it and good luck with it. I so appreciate your time today, Jillian.
Thank you.
The website for more is at jillianmckercher.com. The film is called Lucky Star. It's at the Vancouver International Film Festival tomorrow and Saturday. Visit viff.org for tickets and information. Jillian McKercher joined me on the line from Calgary in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.